What were the political and geostrategic factors that led to the removal of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide from office? Is Haiti in any way different from other nations where the U.S. has instigated regime change? Why was Canada involved in this coup, and what happened in the infamous Ottawa Initiative on Haiti the previous year? On the occasion of the 10th anniversary of the coup d'etat which removed the Haitian leader from office, the Global Research News Hour discusses this incident with Jean Saint-Ville, Haitian-born activist and one of the founding members of the Canada-Haiti Action Network, and with Michel Chossadovsky, the award-winning author and founder of the Center for Research on Globalization. On today's program, Haiti, Anatomy of a Coup d'Etat. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 28th, 2014. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major stories shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. Our show is also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Right Sector is a shadowy syndicate of self-described autonomous nationalists identified by their skinhead style of dress, ascetic lifestyle, and fascination with street violence. Armed with riot shields and clubs, the group's cadres have manned the front lines of the Euromaidan battles this month, filling the air with their signature chant, Ukraine above all, with Svoboda linked to a constellation of international neo-fascist parties through the Alliance of European National Movements, Right Sector is promising to lead its army of aimless, disillusioned young men on a great European reconquest. Svoboda's openly pro-Nazi politics have not deterred Senator John McCain from addressing a Euromaidan rally alongside Tianibok, nor did it prevent Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland from enjoying a friendly meeting with the Svoboda leader this February. In a leaked phone conversation with Jeffrey Piat, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Nuland revealed her wish for Tianibok to remain, quote, on the outside, but to consult with the U.S.'s replacement for Yanukovych, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, four times a week. That's from the article, Is the U.S. Backing Neo-Nazis in Ukraine? By Max Blumenthal, posted February 25th, originally published at Alternet. Within the Western media, the news coverage of the neo-Nazi threat to the Jewish community in Ukraine is a taboo. Ironically, while the Israeli media dismisses the matter, the Arab media has provided a far more balanced assessment of the threat to the Jewish community in Ukraine. Quoting from the Al Jazeera article by John Batchelor, rabbis in Kiev and across Ukraine spoke out, warning their congregations to stay off the streets and remain in their homes. The Jewish agency in Jerusalem has moved swiftly to offer aid to elderly Jews living in Greater Kiev. The fresh report of the firebombing of a new synagogue in Zaporizhia, 250 miles southeast of Kiev, increased the alarm in Israel and accelerated planning for all contingencies, including evacuations. That's from the article, Ukraine and the Politics of Anti-Semitism, The West Upholds Neo-Nazi Repression of Ukraine's Jewish Community, by Michel Chossadovsky, posted February 26th. It was not in the interest of Yanukovych to order the targeted killings of civilians by rooftop snipers. Underlying U.S. foreign policy and CIA intelligence ops, civilian deaths are often triggered deliberately with a view to accusing the enemy and demonizing a foreign head of state or head of government. The Maidan sniper killings are, in this regard, reminiscent of what occurred in Syria in mid-March 2011, at the very outset of the insurgency. Civilians were killed by rooftop snipers in the border city of Daraa. The resulting casualties, without further investigation, were blamed on the government of Bashar al-Assad. It was subsequently confirmed by Israeli and Lebanese press reports that the snipers were hired mercenaries. That is from the article, Ukraine's Democratic Coup d'Etat, Killing Civilians as a Pretext for Regime Change, also by Michel Chosudovsky, posted February 26th. With the overthrow of the Yanukovych government, the $15 billion of promised Russian financial assistance to Ukraine is in doubt. According to Moody's rating agency, Ukraine will require $24 billion to cover a budget deficit, debt repayments, natural gas bills, and pension support just in 2014. Without Moscow's continued bond purchasing and other forms of financial aid, and with pro-EU forces taking control of the country's economic and foreign policy, the outcome is not hard to predict. A rescue package from Europe and the IMF with all the usual austerity conditions attached. In exchange for European aid, Ukraine will be forced to accept the driving down of wages, significant cuts to the public sector and social services, in addition to a rise in taxes on the working class and slashing of pensions. Moreover, the country will be compelled to accede to a liberalization program that will allow Europe to dump goods into the Ukrainian market, deregulation, and the further opening up of the country's financial sector to predatory speculation and privatization. That's from the article, Ukraine's Sickness and Europe's Cure, Neoliberalism and Neo-Fascism Join Hands, by Eric Dreitzer, posted February 25th. As Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland made clear in her speech last December and in the leaked recording of her telephone conversation with the U.S. ambassador in Kiev, Washington spent $5 billion of U.S. taxpayer dollars engineering a coup in Ukraine that overthrew the elected democratic government. There is no doubt whatsoever that the coup is a strategic move by Washington to weaken Russia. The loss of Ukraine to the EU and NATO would mean the loss of Russia's naval base on the Black Sea and the loss of many military industries. The question at the moment is whether Washington miscalculated and lost control of the coup to the neo-Nazi elements who seem to have taken control from the Washington-paid moderates in Kiev, or whether the Washington neocons have been working with the neo-Nazis for years. If Washington has lost control of the coup and is unable to restore control to the moderates whom it has aligned with the EU and NATO, war would seem to be unavoidable. There is no doubt that the Russian provinces would seek and be granted Russia's protection. That comes from the article, The Crisis in Ukraine, What It Means to be Looted by the West, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted February 25th, originally appearing at paulcraigroberts.org. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. I'm speaking right now with Jean Saint-Ville. He is a Haitian-born activist and one of the founding members of the Canada-Haiti Action Network. He's also been to Haiti several times over the last 10 years since the coup, which removed Aristide from power. So, Jean Saint-Ville, you are also active with something called the Apology to Haiti. Maybe I'll just get you to briefly explain that event. It's, of course, related to the coup.
Yes, indeed. So February 29th, 2004 is the date of the coup in Haiti. Of course, this year there's no 29th. It is February 28th. That is the anniversary of the coup. And so a group of activists in Canada has decided that, provided that it is clear now that Canadian officials were involved in the overthrow of the democratically elected president of Haiti, and that the United States and France were chiefly involved in it as well, it is left to the citizens to take a critical look at what happened. And having done so, they decided that as a gesture of solidarity with the Haitian people, they will issue a letter of apology outlining exactly how the officials in their country have participated in the illegal, violent, and racist removal of Haiti's head of state on February 29th, 2004.
What is known about the Ottawa Initiative, about what they discussed, about who was there, that you know, informs our understanding of the events that would follow a year later?
Yeah, so the first element that came out, and some people consider that actually it was a trial balloon, it was done on purpose. It was a leak in L'Actualité, which is a French language paper published in Montreal, Quebec. The title was, of course it was written in French, Haiti put under UN tutelage. And the subtitle was that Aristide must go, and it is not the Haitian opposition calling for that, but rather a set of foreign ministers at the invitation of Canada. And in this article, Michel Vastel presented what he says was revelations given to him through Denis Paradis himself, who had called the meeting, that at that meeting they had decided that Aristide must go, Haiti must be put under UN tutelage, and they need to reinstate the military. And Haiti has been without a military since it was disbanded in 1995 when President Aristide was returning from exile. He had returned from exile in 1994, and in 1995 the army was disbanded and Haiti was functioning with a police force. And so when those things came out in 2003, people were startled because the idea of putting the country under occupation was, of course, revolting for everybody. But more than that, they specified that this had to happen before January 1st, 2004, which, of course, is the date, the anniversary, the bicentennial of the end of racial slavery in the Americas. In fact, that started in Haiti with the Haitian Revolution. And the very fact that this meeting that took place at the government resort involved only white people. It was quite shocking for people around the world to think that a group of white people could meet in Canada to decide they're going to remove the black president of Haiti the very year of the bicentennial of the end of racial slavery. And in fact, you can see the reaction at the end when it started to become evident that this wasn't only the crazy dream of some, you know, folks, but that it was actually being implemented a year later when President Aristide was picked up the dead of night with his wife in his house by white soldiers who entered their house and told them that it's over, they have to go. And it became even more shocking when people realized that just like President Hugo Chavez suffered an attempted coup and they spent 20 hours in the air flying, trying to find a place to dump him. And you know, in 2002, the coup not succeeded in Venezuela, but in Haiti, they managed to drop President Aristide and his wife in a French protectorate at the time in the Central African Republic, where a former dictator was ruling, Sissé, who since had a fallout with the French, and that country is also in bloodshed right now. However, the sheer racial connotation of this coup galvanized support in the Caribbean against it. So all the members of the Caribbean community denounced the coup. Of course, the African Union, several countries of the African Union denounced the coup. And in the United States, the Congressional Black Caucus, of course, denounced the coup. And you contrast that with the situation in white United States at the time. I have to make that distinction because that's how it happened, especially when the racial elements are so clear in on the ground in Haiti, where the leaders of the coup movement in Haiti among the Haitians was actually a white American businessman named André Appède, who created this group of 184 and then this thing called Convergence Démocratique. And so there is, I guess, racial affinity between the Haitians and their former, their foreign supporters, and they basically just paid no respect at all to the historical connections of their actions. And as the years go after the coup took place, this would become even more blatant that the goal is basically to take over the control of Haiti and in no uncertain terms. And we started seeing reports from Canadian soldiers who are putting out solutions to the Haitian problem. And they're saying that the solution might appear colonial, but we have to do it because we cannot let Haitians run Haiti. And it wasn't just individual soldiers saying this thing. I personally faced the then second-in-command at the Organization of American States, Luigi Einaudi, the evening before the January 1st, 2004 celebrations at the Montana Hotel. And Luigi Einaudi said, in front of myself, journalist Kevin Pina, my spouse who was there, and another friend, that the real problem with Haiti is that the international community is so screwed up and divided that they're actually letting Haitians run Haiti. Mm-hmm. We asked them to repeat, and he did. And so that was December 31st, 2003. And less than 2 months later, Haitians were effectively no longer running Haiti. The country was put under foreign troops. At first, it was Americans.
Could you, Jean? Could you maybe just help us, like, just recounting those the days and the lead up to the coup and after? Because we've heard the U.S. ambassador James Foley was quoted as saying that he was that in fact Aristide was not kidnapped. This is a quote: "He is lying. Yeah. He asked for the help of the United States. He begged me. Everyone knows Washington does not keep secrets. All this is to say that it is a big lie." But of course, Aristide has said quite the reverse.
Well, I think the first thing to observe is that this thing happened at night. If Aristide, who is a very talkative head of state, and he was very popular at the time, was leaving Haiti, he would make a speech, especially when even the United States and James Foley and all of these people, what they were saying is that, well, he decided to resign to avoid a bloodshed. Why didn't he leave during the day? Why didn't he make a public statement on TV? In fact, that's what he said. They were saying to him that they were going to take him to a television station and blah, 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 that he was going to appease the population, but not to resign. And then they took him to the airport and took him out. But not only that, it's what happened afterwards. From 2004 to today, every time that the occupation forces organized elections in Haiti, they effectively found a way to not let Jean-Bertrand Aristide's party to register and participate. So it is clear. And also, there is the very military presence of the over 8,000 troops in the country that point to the fact that this was indeed a violent coup d'etat, because Haiti is the only instance where you have a United Nations peacekeeping deployment without a peace agreement, because there was no war in Haiti. The reason why they needed foreign troops is because they knew the premise that they were using was false. That is, that this was an unpopular president who was being chased out by rebels in his country. They knew that wasn't true. The truth is that this was a very popular president, but his popular support comes from very impoverished people who don't have resources to fight back. And so, but they are huge in numbers, so they have to be controlled. And in order to control them, that's why you had U.S. troops, French, Canadian, and Chilean troops at first. And then, in order to put a veneer of legality to the thing, in June 2004, these American troops and were folded within what they call the United Nations mission in Haiti, the MINUSTAH, for the stabilization of Haiti. But that also was illegal, because when they conducted the coup, one of the elements that they had to use was to get rid of the prime minister of Haiti as well, because the country has an executive that has two heads, a president and a prime minister. And Prime Minister Neptune was not complying with the coup, so they jailed him. And so they replaced him with a guy that they picked up in Boca Raton, Florida, Gérard Latortue, and made him prime minister. And it's him who signed the document to authorize the foreign troops of the United Nations in Haiti, which is illegal, because according to the law, it's the head of state who's supposed to do that, not the prime minister, because the prime minister is never elected. So it wasn't even signed by the acting president.
Mm. There were, of course, the individuals who were the leaders within Lavalas who were jailed as political prisoners, and yet you have not just the governments, but also the non-governmental organizations, you know, refusing to recognize them as political prisoners or acknowledge them. Yeah. I've got a quote here from Development and Peace, in which it says, quote, "While there have been serious due process violations in each of the above cases, most were strongly associated with the Aristide government and are believed to be implicated in violent crimes, even if this has never been proven by prosecutors in a dysfunctional judicial system. It is difficult to classify most of these as nonviolent prisoners of conscience, imprisoned for the peaceful expression of their beliefs." That's from a statement from Development and Peace. What do you make of that, that these non-governmental organizations who we normally associate with, well, justice and so on, that they would be having, you know, expressing these sentiments that seem to be very much at odds with the points that you're raising?
Yeah, well, this is a very important case study, I think, the Haitian coup, for anybody who is interested in international politics and trying to understand this thing. So at the center of the Haitian coup is this doctrine of the responsibility to protect. And if you check in the document of the responsibility to protect that was published in 2000, it's clearly outlined in there that the countries who are going to invoke the responsibility to protect in order to take over a state that they consider a failed state, they need to count on sympathy of their own populations. And the instrument that they have identified to achieve that goal is the so-called non-governmental organizations. And so you will see in the Haitian case that they use that to the maximum level. You had organizations like the one you just cited, Rights and Democracy, but you also had Reporters Without Borders. And all of these, when people started to do the study, you realized that they were actually being funded by the State Department through NED grants or the International Republican Institute. In other words, these so-called non-governmental organizations are front organizations to do openly what the CIA was doing in the past covertly. And so, and that was very important because, you know, it played a trick on many people, you know, progressive people to the left, who it took us a while to realize that they were using these so-called non-governmental organizations, with including the media as well. For instance, it took several years before here in Canada you will see the expression coup d'etat put in the press about the bloody coup that took place in Haiti. Because, of course, there's the Charters of the Americas that was adopted that says when there is a violent overthrow or illegal overthrow of a government in the Americas, that all the states will not recognize the government that is issued of the push. But of course, when they organize it themselves, the rich countries simply don't call it a push. They don't call it a coup d'etat. And you will notice that it took many years before on the English side of CBC that they used the term coup d'etat. On the French side, I'm not sure if they've even ever used it. Because, of course, the French side of Radio-Canada has more affinities with the liberal players of the liberal government at the time that were involved in the coup. And it's a paradox that today, if you check the Ottawa Citizen, you will see that human rights lawyer Mario Joseph is mentioned as having called on the mayor of Montreal, Denis Coderre, to apologize to Haitians because he had lied about the coup, because Denis Coderre at the time was the envoy to basically deal with issues of Haiti for the federal government. So, you know, there are many levels of collusion there. And on the case of the coup in Haiti, another neo-colonial organization that was used heavily is the Francophonie. So it's not a coincidence that it was the Minister for La Francophonie, Denis Paradis, that called the plotting meeting a year in advance of the coup, and that you'd see people like Denis Coderre. In other words, they used a lot of the people in Quebec as the colonial, basically, they get to play on places like Haiti and Francophone Africa. Quebec gets to play nation. And that's why even the Bloc Québécois was complicit in the coup, and in the House of Commons, they refused to use the term coup d'etat.
Well, Jean Saint-Ville, if people want more information about the apology to Haiti and the events you mentioned, there is a website?
Yes, indeed, apologytohaiti.ca.
Okay. Well, Jean Saint-Ville, thank you so much for your perspectives on this, and hopefully you'll keep us up to date on anything that goes on with this campaign.
Yes, and indeed, we're keeping it on even after the 28th. Course, after the 1st of March for sure. And there are also non-Canadians who have participated because, of course, if their country was involved in the coup also, they can sign and just put a note saying that, you know, they're from such and such a country. So apologytohaiti.ca is the website.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Jean Saint-Ville, a Haitian-born, Ottawa-based activist and one of the founders of the Canada-Haiti Action Network and an organizer of the Apology to Haiti campaign. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. So what were the political and geostrategic factors that led to the removal of President Aristide from office? These were outlined in the article, U.S.-sponsored coup d'etat, the destabilization of Haiti, published within hours of Aristide's removal by French, U.S., and Canadian forces. The author of the article is Michel Chalcedovsky, Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa and founder of the Center for Research on Globalization. Professor Chalcedovsky is also one of the presenters on the February 28th Apology to Haiti event at 7 p.m. at 233 Gilmort Street, in Ottawa. Professor Chalcedovsky, I understand that there's an event coming out tonight in reference to something called an Apology to Haiti, and you're going to be speaking to that topic. Do you want to just sort of briefly introduce it and why you're taking the position you are?
There is a movement across Canada to the effect that Canada should apologize to Haiti. And many people at the grassroots have signed on to this campaign. But I think the more substantive issue, which we certainly will raise, is that we should not ask our government to say sorry. Our government is responsible for having conducted an illegal act. Our government was involved in a conspiracy to overthrow an elected head of state together with two other governments, namely France and the United States. And we can't simply say to the people of Haiti on behalf of the Canadian government, we're sorry, we made a mistake, we killed people, we're sorry. We have to consider this as a legal issue and apply the concepts of international criminal law. And that means that the authors of this coup have to be indicted for war crimes. There's another aspect. It's the issue of compensation of the victims, and that would be the object of a class action lawsuit directed against the Canadian government. Now, this is not an issue of saying, did they do it or did they not do it? There are official statements which have been recorded by the House of Commons. There's the statement of Stockwell Day, who at the time was an opposition member of parliament, to the effect that there was an involvement of Canada in the unseating of the president of Haiti. And consequently, this is a legal issue. We as Canadians can say we can apologize, and we can apologize. And the best way to apologize is actually to initiate that legal procedure against the government of Canada.
Hmm. Let's talk about that article which you wrote in the hours, essentially about the same time as President Aristide was being kidnapped. What were the factors leading up to that event? Mr. Aristide was obviously at odds with the aims of the United States, Canada, and France. What were some of those factors that basically led to his downfall?
Well, I think essentially President Aristide was acting as a sovereign head of state. He was implementing measures which went against the orders of the International Monetary Fund. He was concerned with increasing the levels of wages. He was also addressing the issue of the drug trade because
Haiti was a transshipment country, and essentially he was not performing the role of a U.S. puppet who was taking orders from the Washington Consensus. But I should mention that going back to the Duvalier era, there was a countervailing power structure of the Haitian elites, the business elites, the people who were running the sweatshops. They had set up what was called a democratic convergence. And then they had the so-called group of 184 civil society organizations. These groups were essentially pushing for regime change. And they were funded by the National Endowment for Democracy. They were in close liaison with the U.S. government at the time. We know that the National Endowment for Democracy works hand in glove with the CIA. It is also composed of the International Republican Institute, which is one of its programs, and that is run by Senator John McCain. At the time, Senator John McCain was chairman of the IRI. Now, those links have characterized the colored revolutions in many countries. How you support so-called democratic dissent or opposition, but in effect, it's the Washington Consensus which is prevailing. It's the role of the IMF in ordering austerity measures. And in addition to that, you had the death squadrons. Mm-hmm. In particular, former Tonton Macoute of the Duvalier era, which were trained in the Dominican Republic by the CIA, and these rebel commanders started waging paramilitary attacks inside Haiti in the weeks preceding the actual military coup.
I know that you've documented similar sorts of attempts to overthrow democratically elected governments in Chile, Venezuela, and elsewhere. I'm wondering if there's anything about Haiti in particular that distinguishes itself. Is this just part of like the same old, or is there something specific about Haiti that is worth mentioning?
Well, I think that each of these countries has specific circumstances. What makes these comparisons important is that they are all subjected to attempts to destabilize political institutions, the national economy, and so on. And there is a pattern, because you can see that the actors from outside are the National Endowment for Democracy, the CIA, the International Monetary Fund, the State Department, and of course the media. Okay, and so I mean I'm schematizing this, but those actors are consistent. They're there, and it's interesting to point out that the U.S. ambassador to Haiti at the time, James Foley, was appointed in September of the previous year, 2003. Now, it just so happens that James Foley was involved in Kosovo, and James Foley was actually pushing the idea that the Kosovo Liberation Army, which was used to destabilize Yugoslavia, this organization had links to the Italian mafia, to the drug trade. And then James Foley said, oh, what we should do is to assist them so that they can become civilian politicians. And so that what they were doing was taking a criminal entity and transforming it into a bona fide political party. And today, of course, the head of government in Kosovo is the former leader of the KLA, Hashim Tashi. Essentially, if you look at Haiti, well, first of all, then James Foley is appointed to Haiti. Who do they support? They support the death squadrons, the former Tonton Macoute. And these death squadrons subsequently then become bona fide politicians who are, who enter the political landscape. So there are certain similarities in how they operate in very different countries. Now, the case of Haiti is important because Haiti was the first country to abolish slavery and the colonial system and against France. And that history is important because I don't think France ever forgave them for actually throwing, the French power out of the country and establishing a sovereign government. They implemented land reform in the early 19th century. We know that Simon Bolivar actually went to Haiti to look at the experience of land reform, so that this is very crucial. But it just so happens that this history has led Haiti to becoming the most impoverished country in the Western Hemisphere. Mm. And the entire policy thrust of the U.S. administration going back to the 90s has been literally to destroy its economy, and the fate of Haitian agriculture is a case in point, where 75% of the Haitian population are engaged in agriculture, producing food crops for the domestic market as well as cash crops for export. And then what happens, the IMF comes in with trade reforms and then opens up the local economy to the dumping of grain surpluses, literally destroying from one day to the next, destroying the basis of this peasant economy. And what happens? The local production of rice in Haiti collapses by 50% in the 90s, and then the U.S. Surpluses are then sent into Haiti. Haiti is one of the largest importers of U.S. rice. So there you are, a small impoverished country in the Caribbean becomes the world's fourth largest importer of American rice after Japan, Mexico, and Canada. Then you have, of course, these sweatshops, and the sweatshops are there, and they're sustained by very, very low wages. And the IMF is sent in essentially to ensure that those wages don't go up. And that, again, is something which President Aristide did not accept, and he started to implement a program of wage increases.
And I guess that Mr. Aristide's efforts were seen as, or at least had been seen as a way of undermining foreign investment, because foreign investors will go to where the wages are the lowest, right?
Well, absolutely. They'll go where the wages are lowest. And what has been the policy of the U.S. government and I would say of global capitalism is through institutions like the World Bank and the IMF is to make sure that those wages don't go up. And that what they say to the countries is if your wages go up, you're no longer competitive. But to build an economy based on poverty, where poverty is input into the success of an export economy, is an absurd proposition. Because it essentially means, the country will only progress if it's poor. Now, the other aspect was the narcotics transshipment trade. At the time, now things have changed, that something of the order 15% of cocaine, which produced in Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia, entered the United States through Haiti. So that Haiti was a country of transshipment, and the military governments were protecting this drug trade in liaison with the CIA. Now, the irony is that these links of the Haitian military to the CIA, they were very carefully documented in what was called the Kerry Commission, and in the late 80s, Senator John Kerry was chairman of the Subcommittee on Narcotics, Terrorism, and International Operations of the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, and he was entrusted with a major investigation which focused on the links between the CIA, the drug trade, the laundering of drug money, the financing of insurgencies, and so on. It wasn't limited to Haiti, but it certainly revealed some of these relations. Now, John Kerry today is the Secretary of State, and he knows a lot about the whole background, but nonetheless, I think he has he's now performing a somewhat more compliant role, and he's certainly not raising the links between the U.S. state and U.S. intelligence on the one hand and the drug trade. Those links, I mean, are also prevalent in other countries, including Mexico, as we know, and recent reports have revealed it.
Talk about the special role of Canada, because we know that the United States has been very much involved in undermining democracies. Whether it's Chile, Guatemala, and other places, but it seems as if Haiti has there's something special about Haiti that's accorded Canada's very enthusiastic involvement. Do you have an explanation for that?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that there's an important Haitian community in the province of Quebec, and there are lots of people going back and forth. There are many Haitian university professors, intellectuals, doctors. The Haitian community is not homogeneous. Some of them will, of course, were firm supporters of Aristide, and others were actually involved in the with the military governments and so on and so forth. I suspect it had a lot to do with that relationship. And the fact that there's important investments in Canadian investments in Haiti, including, of course, the Canadian chartered banks, are present. But there's another aspect to this. The United States has always sought to intervene with other countries playing the dirty role, so to speak. We can see this in Syria. What do? They send in Turkey, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Qatar, playing a dirty role in support of the Al-Qaeda affiliated terrorists, and they will not necessarily be visibly involved in those actions, even though they coordinate it. Now, of course, Canada has a long-standing bilateral relationship with the United States in many areas, but particularly in the areas of foreign policy, intelligence, military cooperation, which is very important. This relationship ultimately facilitates the role of Canada. Canada is, to some extent, also led by a puppet government, okay? A U.S.-sponsored puppet government. So, and that's not something which, that's not something new. It's perhaps much more visible with the Harper administration, with the Harper government, than it was previously. But we do comply with U.S. foreign policy positions. At least in recent history, we've complied. Mm. I'm not talking about other periods in history under Diefenbaker and Pearson and so on, but we are compliant, and it serves the United States to use other countries. France was involved because of its historical, because it was the former colonial power, and it also has important bilateral relations with Haiti, so that these were the ideal partners. But again, if we look at the dynamics of this military coup, the United States was the lead, was playing the lead role.
Professor Chossudovsky, in your 10-year-old article, you also mentioned something about the militarization of the Caribbean Basin. What's the geostrategic significance of Haiti as a location to locate U.S. Military presence?
The Caribbean has important resources in terms of minerals and energy. And bear in mind that Haiti is also, you know, in a sense, strategically located in relation to both Cuba and Venezuela and Central America. I mean, Cuba, of course, is still a potential target of U.S. Foreign policy, okay? And the fact that Haiti is very close to the Cuban to Cuba is of course an important consideration. And then further south you have Venezuela, so that the project is to militarize the Caribbean, and that's not necessarily limited to Haiti. Other countries which of course, which have played a very important role in terms of militarization is Panama, on the one hand, as well as of course Colombia, which has an important, which also has a coastline on the Mediterranean. On the Caribbean Basin.
Is there a possibility of Haiti reasserting its sovereignty in the future, or is it pretty much? Has the United States, Canada, and the UN and international forces essentially put an end to the, any kind of resurgence, a true democratic resurgence?
Well, the Levelas movement is still a very important movement, but it's based on grassroots actions in the slum areas of Port-au-Prince. It doesn't have the thrust that it had during the Aristide period. But in the meantime, of course, Haiti has undergone several other crises, including the earthquake. And the earthquake has led to a new phase of so-called foreign investment, where, in fact, the whole, all the institutions of the country collapsed, so that you didn't have anybody to regulate. What I understand is that in the wake of the earthquake, mining companies come in and virtually they handed large portions of Haitian territory on a silver platter, because there's absolutely no governmental structure there to regulate and to protect the rights of Haitians and their land rights and their rights to their own, the wealth of the country. And I think that in effect was the objective of the coup d'etat, was to essentially transform this country into a territory. that is ultimately the objective of many interventions of the United States and its allies, is to destroy an entire country and transform that country into an open territory where foreign investors go in. They use the local people as cheap labor. They have free access to natural resources, which they can export, energy, and so on. And we have many examples of that. IMF reforms are particularly devastating because they can, through the manipulation of market forces, lead to the impoverishment of the very rapid impoverishment of an entire population. And I should mention in the Ukraine, and that's very important to understand the history. In 1994, the Ukraine government, the Ukrainian government of Leonid Kuchma, signed an agreement with the International Monetary Fund, and from one day to the next, electricity prices went up 600%. The price of bread went up 300%, and virtually overnight, that country was, its economy was destabilized. And one of the sectors which was destabilized was its breadbasket. The Ukraine was the largest producer of wheat, one of the largest in the world. And what did they do is that by manipulating energy prices, on the one hand, you know, a 600% increase in fuel prices. Transportation went up 900%. And then at the same time, imposing free trade and the dumping of commodity surpluses, that breadbasket is destroyed. Another country where the breadbasket was destroyed is Egypt, the Nile Valley. And they did exactly the same. They opened up the country to free trade, and they hiked up the fuel prices. They froze credit to the farmers. The Nile Valley was pushed into stagnation, programmed stagnation. And then what happened? Egypt becomes one of the major importers of U.S. and EU grain surpluses. So there's a certain similarity. Destroying the breadbasket, destroying agriculture is of course, an objective. And we can recall Kissinger's famous
And that marks
words,
the end of our show for this week.
Control the food, control the people. And that's precisely what they've done in country after country. And this is not to say that they will be able to continue doing this, because there are resistance movements, and certainly in Haiti there is a resistance movement, and people understand. They're not, you know, they understand the logic of this foreign intervention in the in the internal affairs of a sovereign state.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good way of tying up this conversation, at least for now. Professor Chossudovsky, I want to thank you very much for that analysis on this 10-year anniversary.
Thank you very much.
Professor Michel Chossudovsky, an award-winning author, Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa, and founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.